This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. Tonight, we've got our one sponsor for the show, and that's our good friends at Jamf Software, makers of Jamf Pro and Jamf Now, device management software for Mac, iPad, iPhone, Apple TV, and more. Bradley, how's it going?
Going good. We are back in the swing from Christmas mm-hmm. break, and we had a snow day on Monday just because there was a lot of ice on the road.
Perfect.
When the show comes out, we'll also be off because it's the day in the U.S. that we celebrate Martin Luther King. So most of the schools in America are shut down that day. It's, banks and whatnot are all shut down. So, yeah.
Okay.
But we're getting back at it. Did you guys have a good break from school?
We did. Well, I got sick over Christmas. I literally got sick on Christmas Day, which is a classic kind of teacher problem is, you know, you have your holiday and then 2 days after your holiday starts, you just die of some kind of illness that you've been holding off until the end of term. So I was sick on Christmas Day. I was in bed on Christmas Day and Boxing Day, and I had about 3 or 4 days in bed, actually. I was really quite unwell. But I have to say, I can't remember a more relaxing Christmas because I just got to sit in bed for 4 days, which was actually probably the best thing that could have happened.
Yeah, that's not something you do with small children, that's for sure. But lots of things to put together.
Oh, yeah. There's Lego piled up in this house that hasn't even been opened yet. It's... just waiting for the moment.
Well, see, that's my problem with Legos. And like my kids' ages, it's like my oldest is 7. And so he, like some of those harder sets, like he just can't do mm-hmm. them. And so it basically becomes yeah. toys that dad has to put together that then continually break. So they're kind of my nightmare. And there's a part of me that wishes there was like a line of Legos that everything looked like Legos, but they didn't come apart.
You glue them as you build them.
Right. Well, you know, it's like I see like give me like the, because he loves the little minifigures. Like, give me the minifigure with like an X-Wing that's already built that doesn't break, that, but looks like it's made out of Legos. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. Like a Lego toy, basically. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting. So, from a teaching point of view, something, I don't know if you've seen the Lego Juniors line of toys. It's like you've got Duplo and then you've got Lego Juniors and then you've got sort of proper Lego. The Lego Junior stuff is absolute genius because if you look at, like, Georgia's 4.5 and she can just about build the Lego Juniors kit by herself now because the instruction booklet for Lego Juniors is really thick because every single step of the instructions has only got between 1 and 2 pieces that you have to add on to the kit. They don't give you anything where you put 5 bits on in one picture. It's one piece at a time. And they also make it so that you almost never have to rotate the piece before you put it on, so it's always the same orientation. If you just hold it one way, you can build the whole thing. And then what they also do with the kit is they make it so that you basically build 4 little parts that are disconnected, and that becomes the set that you play with. So, for example, George has got one, it's like the Little Mermaid or something like that, and it's got Ariel's house, which is the bigger part, and then it's got her chariot, which is a separate piece, and then, you know, a dressing table or something, which is another piece. But all of those pieces are standalone, so you only have to put together maybe 6 to 8, maybe 10 or 15 pieces for the biggest part. It's just really, really clever for kids of that age. It's just so well designed from an instruction point of view. I think every teacher should get a Lego Juniors kit and just study it. It's really well done.
That's a good point. Those Duplo sets are good. I haven't seen the Juniors, so I will have to check those out. One thing I meant to mention, we got a chance over this week to kind of leverage our emergency notification system in terms of, hey, let people know school's canceled. And you did a fun project with that here recently, so I was going to lead you up into talking about that.
Yeah, I got a project dropped into my lap, which was a project where we wanted to send out regular reminders, scheduled reminders about things, and to do it to quite a diverse range of people who may or may not be tech savvy. So, you know, the first place your mind always goes with that is, right, you know, a smartphone app and a push notification or something like that. But in fact, it turned out to be far easier for us just to do an SMS-based kind of broadcast thing. And so I got given this project and it was like, you've basically got 1 week to turn this around from, you know, learning about it to getting it up and running. So what I discovered, I didn't really know very much about SMS marketing or broadcasting or anything like that. It turns out there's tons of platforms that you can use to do this. Lots of, we ended up using a service called FireText, which is just, I chose it as one of many results on Google for, you know, SMS broadcast. But what we did was we were able to subscribe to a custom keyword. So they have a short code, like, and I think theirs was 82228. So it's 5 digits that you text your message to that number. And it's the same short code for every user of that service, but you have a custom keyword. So you would text foo to that number and you would join our mailing list. And it's quite cool because if you have different codes, you can, the people who join your list can go into different groups, and then you can message different groups based on whatever it is you want to say. So that was quite nice because I didn't want to have to like manually gather everybody's phone numbers and things like that. That was there's no way I was starting to be the janitor for that stuff. So people can subscribe themselves. They can unsubscribe themselves by texting the same keyword and the word stop to the same number again. And then what I did is the platform we used, and many platforms have got this, they have an HTTP REST API. So what I did to complete the automation was, on Amazon Web Services, there's this thing called AWS Lambda, which is a component of AWS where you can basically write a script, like a Python script or a Node.js script or something, and that script will get run in response to various AWS events. Now, what this is really for, I think, is for things like, say, your Netflix, and demand goes through the roof for something, you can actually, the demand monitoring triggers, it can actually trigger one of these scripts, and your script could like fire up more instances of your servers or something like that. But one of the ways you can also run them is just in response to a scheduled trigger. So you can write a cron expression, which is a kind of time-based expression for when things should happen. You just write that and AWS will trigger your script on that cron schedule. So I just wrote a script that called the API for this text messaging service and put it into AWS Lambda, set up a cron expression to trigger that, and then every day whenever we want, when the time comes to send it that message, it just happens automatically. So it's not on any of my servers, it's all in the cloud, which is really cool. AWS Lambda is super cool. I don't see that many people talking about it, but it's just a really cool feature because it's super flexible. You can basically write any Python script. You can even upload libraries and stuff if you zip them correctly yourself. We also use it, Bradley. We've talked before in the show about our use of Amazon Workspaces at school, for example. And Amazon Workspaces is a virtual Windows desktop product, but it takes like 5 to 10 minutes for it to kind of resume, depending on how much stuff the user's got going when their machine was suspended. It takes a while to resume. So we also use a similar technique with Lambda to automatically launch those instances 10 or 15 minutes before the class starts, so that they're warmed up in time for the class to come in as well. So I'm finding sort of more and more new uses for AWS Lambda just as we go through these kind of things. But yeah, that's quite a fun project. And I think it kind of speaks to the sort of thing that I kind of feel right now, Bradley, which is that nothing's really difficult anymore. You know, I don't know of many things online that are genuinely still hard to do. I mean, like probably live streaming a internationally interested sports game is probably hard to do, right? You know, live streaming the Super Bowl is difficult, but, you know, at a normal person scale, there are so many just bits and pieces lying about that you can integrate. It's so cool. And this is all costing like pennies a time. It's not highly expensive. There's not a lot of capital to get started with. And that's what I think is just so cool about, you know, cloud-based computing and all of these kind of web services and stuff. You can just get started for basically no money. And then if it scales up, presumably you can scale up your income to match it as well.
Yeah, I would second that, because things that are complicated are opportunities for people to package them simpler and sell that.
Yeah.
And I mean, the live streaming is a good example. Obviously, like streaming the Super Bowl is very difficult. But even like there's companies out there that do that. Like for our like school events that we live stream, we use a program, I think it's called Wirecast, and then it hooks into Facebook Live and onto StreamMonkey. And like StreamMonkey, we embed it into our website, literally, you know, and into our app, literally works. Good example is our app that we talked about here recently. Like I'm not an app developer, but I can build out the content of an app and then somebody else can kind of code the back end. And I found a solution online that can do that for less than $100 a month. And it really, our parents are loving it. We do get push notifications. Even on the SMS front, like we have this built into our SIS. We do pay, you know, per student per month or per family per month. But it's like it's an app that can literally trigger an SMS to 600 people from our app. And I can do the same thing with a phone call. Like I can record a message into the app and it blasts it out as a phone call. And so we had to use that this week. And I mean, literally, it takes me 5 minutes to send out a quick text and make a quick phone call, go to every family we have. The downside to our solution is it's the downside and the good side. So the downside is that it's not something people can just kind of subscribe to. you have to be kind of, you know, your information has to be in our student information system. So that does in some ways make us the, as you said, janitor of the information, but parents have access to go in there to add information and whatnot. But from a parent perspective, they don't have to sign up for anything new.
Yeah, that's we do that with our MailChimp. We send a lot of kind of email stuff and we use MailChimp for that. But it's always like the hardest part is, you know, sometimes you want to, you've got parents' email addresses in that system. And we also have them tagged with like custom columns for what year group their children are in. So we can slice the list to only, you know, parents of first year pupils or second year pupils or something like that. And that mostly works, but it's quite a bit of effort at the start of every year to just get everybody into that system. And, you know, if somebody changes their email address or something and they forget to tell us, then it can be a while before we know about that. So I wouldn't say there's a perfect solution just yet. I mean, maybe it's something that we can develop a little bit more and a bit more self-service stuff. But I was really pleased that setting up this SMS system, people find that like trivially easy to do. Even people who are not particularly tech savvy, everybody's text messaging, you know, it doesn't matter almost what kind of generation of technology you're in, you're still texting people now. So I was really pleased with how well that went.
Before we move on to our main topic tonight, let's thank our sponsor, is the great folks at Jamf. Jamf Pro is the best solution for deploying, managing, and securing your Apple devices in your school. Over 3 million students are empowered by Jamf every day, bringing learning to a whole new level for your students by providing the tools they need to be successful in today's classroom. Start a free trial at jamf.com. That's jamf.com. So what we want to talk about tonight is kind of an update to something we've discussed, you know, many times in the past. It's a evolution in document sharing in schools and in the enterprise. And so I've been around in the work world for, I don't know, 13 years now. And so like it's been interesting. And when I first came in, like mobility and multi-device users, it wasn't a thing. So like, you know, think about the typical, this was 2004, the typical, you know, enterprise or school was you had a Windows domain controller. You logged on. There was probably a general shared drive. You know, I know a lot of people usually put it as the S drive on the network. And then users also had their P drives, which was like a personal drive that only you and assuming IT could access. But that wasn't something that was like automatically shared. Was that kind of your experience, Fraser?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, we in our early days, we were using Mac OS X server. I mean, literally my first kind of network that I built was, it was Mac OS X server 1.0, right? You remember like the very earliest days of Mac OS X, where it still looked like Mac OS 9. And we had Mac OS 9 clients, iMacs, net booting off of that. So we were doing a lot of net boot stuff, but also home directories on the servers. This was 1999. And I think as far as I keep making this claim and nobody contradicts me yet, but I'm pretty sure we were the first school anywhere around to have like a common desktop login system. So most schools were still using, like, there was one PC and there was a box of floppy disks, and logging in meant putting your floppy disk into the computer, and that was it set up for you. But we had four or five iMacs, I think, in the school at the time, and you could sit down at any iMac and log in, and you would get your desktop, which was kind of cool even back then. And that was how we did it, was kind of shared home directories at that point. It was pretty ropey, but it did mostly work.
Well, and then you think about the evolution of like computing. What happened is like we all of a sudden ended up with, you know, more than one device, and they all were mobile. So you didn't always have the, you weren't always kind of quote on the network. You may have been offsite, you may have been at home, and maybe you didn't have a VPN connection. And for the longest time, I would hear people say we expect 3 to 5 devices per user, and I would think like, well, that's crazy. But like when you consider wearables that like, a lot of people do have 4 already, and it's like, wow, it's very much the thing now, and how those documents interact. I mean, that multi-device world, to me, how that changed document sharing was kind of, you know, that was hard. And that's why network drives were the technology for that period. Like you would sign onto the network, you would have your network drive there. And then but those kind of things, like, you know, when you picked up your first iPhone, like it couldn't necessarily hook into your Exchange shared drive. There wasn't obviously like Office for the iPhone, but you know what I'm saying? Like that stuff didn't exist to the iPhone. And that's
I mean,
where
the boundary you're talking about, Bradley, is really the difference between there's one computer shared between multiple users, and we've gone from that world to one user having multiple computers that they don't share with anybody, right? So you don't really share your iPad with anybody, you don't share your phone with anybody, you don't. Most people have got a laptop to themselves now as well. So we have all these multiple computers that are exclusive to our use, as opposed to one computer that's shared between like maybe 15 or 20 users. And that's, it's keeping your data in sync across those devices is kind of the new world, or the new problem, if you like, as opposed to getting access to your files on a computer that's not actually yours. And that was kind of what I was talking about in terms of the old desktop login system was, there's a computer that somebody else might have used that now you want to use, and you need to make it like your computer. So that's why the home directory was off from the server, whereas now the home directory, the computer storage is all yours, but which one did you last touch? And it's keeping them in sync that's a problem, rather than getting access to your stuff.
So the original solution here that came on, like, you know, I guess 08 timeframe, was Dropbox. And so this was, at the time, and in some ways still is, like, so simple to explain. It's like, look, you put your stuff in this folder, and it just syncs. Syncs to Dropbox's cloud. It syncs to their, you know, your other computers. You, at the time, they didn't even have an iPhone app. It was a, you know, like a web app, and syncs everywhere. And that, it worked well. Like, the premise of it really, really worked well, and it was pulled off. And then, like, we saw, like, in 2010, like, iCloud came out, and its idea was the cloud was king. That's when kind of the iCloud was the king in terms
of, like, the truth is in the cloud.
The truth is in the cloud. And so you had one version that, you know, the way Steve explained it was, it would be pushed from your Mac down to your other devices through the cloud. And it worked okay. I mean, to me, iCloud has really just now come to where, like, I trust it 100% with my data. I mean, I guess that is my primary way I store my data on my computer. That's quote unquote personal. So I'll explain the difference in that in a second. But that's the kind of the original iCloud promise.
Yeah, I think in the early days of iCloud, one of the biggest problems with sort of working across iOS and Mac platforms was that apps like Keynote and Pages, which were supposed to be like the best iCloud citizens, if you edited a file on the iOS version of that app or you edited it on the Mac version, you would get sort of different artifacts or different effects. So, for example, I remember at one point, I think maybe this might have been 2012, something like that. If you created a presentation on Keynote for the Mac, those templates used fonts that were not available in iOS. So if you synced it over to iOS, it would come up and go, oh, your thing doesn't have it. You don't have the right fonts on this device. And then back and forth. So even like the templates that had the same name had different properties on iOS. And all of that's been straightened out. And I think, to be honest with you, a lot of the work that's gone into making iCloud, or sort of not iCloud, but iWork very consistent on both Mac and iOS platforms has gone a long way to making that kind of seamless workflow a lot easier.
Yeah, and really, and around this time as well, Google Apps started to become big. And now, when we first went to Google Apps, Google Drive necessarily wasn't a thing. There was, in terms of, like, I don't think the branding was there yet. So, like, there was Google Docs and Google Spreadsheets and even Google Slides, but they weren't really like, there wasn't a cohesive ecosystem.
They kind of lived in the cloud by themselves, didn't they?
Right. Yeah. And really through that, like, you know, that's kind of the 2010, 2011 timeframe for a lot of organizations, including us. Once you adopted the Google Apps ecosystem, it's called G Suite now, which I think it's a terrible name. That has become kind of the default place for our documents. And that's, you know, I would call it, it's the new .doc. And that means that for the longest time, .doc was the default thing for everything that was computing based. Like, it was, everything was in a word processor, and it was all about Word documents. You had to have Word documents. And now we have computers here that don't even have Word, and the users don't even know or care because their documents are in Google Drive. For example, our entire school budget is planned in a Google spreadsheet. So that's kind of where we ended up. Like, you know, kind of the evolution from P drives to things like Dropbox, and then the kind of the promise of iCloud, And then Google Drive and the G Suite ecosystem, while it's not the best, really because it's hooked in to our entire identity management system, being our email addresses, it became the default, for better or worse. It's not perfect. It's garbage on iOS, but it so became
getting worse than iOS.
Right. Yeah. It became the default. Yep. And they've kind of extended this out to the Google Drive app for desktop. So there's a new one. They kind of, you know, there used to be the same one. So there was a Drive app for desktop that worked very similar to Dropbox. And it was a, you know, it was a folder that synced. You put stuff in there that had the little check mark with it. It worked well. I never thought it worked as well as Dropbox, particularly for big files, but it did work well. Now, they had this new thing for schools and enterprises called FileStream. And, you know, it works fine. Like, it works well. And what this does that the old Drive didn't do is it shows everything you have, including your team drives, we'll talk about in a few minutes. But you don't have to store everything locally. So it kind of just shows you, like, a picture of the file. And then when you go to open it, it essentially downloads it. So it integrates in with Windows Explorer, the Finder on the Mac. And you can even open, like if you say throw an Excel sheet in there, it may, you'll convert it on the Google side to Google Spreadsheet, but you can still open it natively in Excel on your computer, if that makes sense. So yeah, you know, that's kind of the, where they're at right now on the Mac. I have Google Drive on iOS. The problem with that is the Files app integration is really not there. It doesn't work.
It should never have shipped. It's embarrassing. It's just terrible. I don't know how Apple let that through, to be honest with you. I mean, it's just what I see. I mean, I have a large Google Drive, right? I have about 1.2 terabytes on Google Drive, for example. A lot of that is archival stuff, like all the old podcast files and stuff, all the master files for the show. I just dump them in Google Drive or whatever. But what I see in Files in iOS is that you can navigate about two or three folders, and then the extension just seems to crash, and it just comes up and says, this could not be loaded for some unknown error. And all the file counts are wrong. It shows you every folder looks like it's got one file in it, even though some of them have got a lot more. I don't know if it's just that it's trying to, you know, do a deep enumeration of all my files and I've got too many or something like that. But I agree with you, Bradley, what you said about, you know, Google Docs becoming kind of de facto, because Google owns identity, right, in many organizations, and increasingly that's becoming the thing. And I mean, I was having this conversation with a friend today we were just sort of saying, you know, like the Google strategy for getting into schools is just super pragmatic, and the Apple one is really idealistic. And it seems like in a large number of places, pragmatism is really winning out, you know. And I've sometimes called this like cheaper typing, right? That I know there are a lot of schools who they basically want to do the exact same thing that they've done with computers for 20 years. Type word processing documents, work on spreadsheets, do presentations, but they just want to do it for like half the cost. So you buy a Chromebook, and in many cases, I know one of our listeners who works in the field has told us that a lot of schools, what they're doing is they're buying Chromebooks, and then they're setting up all the pointers to point to Office 365. So they're actually using the Microsoft versions of the online stuff, but they're doing it through Chromebook as well. So either you're in Google Apps or you're in 365, those seem to be the two things. And I really feel that the Apple School Manager is just way too little, way too late on that. And I think that, I don't know if it's game over yet, but it's like almost game over. You know, if people are going to move to a new thing, they're probably going to either stick with Microsoft, who they know, or they're going to go to Google. But nobody's building their identity platform around Apple School Manager, and it's just not even that kind of product, I don't suppose.
Yeah, and this goes back to, this is the problem for iCloud, is there isn't an enterprise identity management system that can encompass everything. Like you have to have another thing to do your enterprise email. And so that's the issue with making iCloud, like we're going to go all in on iWork. Number one, they can't do shared folders. That's the first issue. Well, I guess the second one, but the main one's the identity management piece. Now, one thing that Google has created in the past year that I think is really, really awesome and has really solved the need for a lot of organizations is Team Drives. And so what makes Team Drives different from normal shared folders is there are no owners. And let me give you an example. So like a couple years ago, we had a person leave at the end of the year, and deleted her account. Well, apparently she was the owner of like kind of like a document a lot of people kind of had saved. Well, I had no idea. And this was before Google had the option, like when you delete, to reassign someone's documents. And that's like almost by default now. You have to almost, I think you have to uncheck it to not do it.
Yeah, you do.
And so that's obviously huge. So the good thing about team drives, though, is it doesn't matter. Like once something's in a team drive, like anybody that has access to that team drive can access and edit it and whatnot. So that is going to be a really nice thing for us. And I think this may be some of the difficulty with the kind of how the Files app work is because Google has this entirely almost like a cloud OS or a drive OS. And it's hard to translate that down to the Files app, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you can see there's a clear impedance mismatch there between, you know, you're basically looking at Google Drive as a computer to which multiple volumes are attached, right? In the same way that you would plug in an external USB drive to your computer and you would see the internal storage, which is your Google Drive, and then these team drives kind of attached as well, like the network shared drives. And Apple Files doesn't really have that kind of model. You know, it has, the idea there is that the cloud storage is like a drive and all the drives appear in files. But then inside Google Drive, you've kind of got these multiple drives inside there. And there doesn't seem to be a good way to represent that inside files at the moment.
That's kind of, you know, Google Team Drives in a nutshell. And the nice thing is for Google File Stream users, you have access to all your team drives as well. We've used it. We have a school office one. We have like a marketing one that some of us use. And then I know a lot of our teachers have kind of grade level stuff. So like first grade has a team drive, second grade has a team drive, fifth grade has a team drive. And that's kind of become their kind of de facto place for things. Because that way, you know, if it's lesson plans or resources they've got, everyone kind of can get access to them. So overall, like there are aspects of Google Docs and Google Spreadsheets and Google Slides that are not the best. Like, I would not say that Google Docs is the best word processor on the market. I'm not actually sure what I would say, to be honest with you. What would you say, Fraser?
For me, it very much depends on what it is you're trying to do. I mean, for example, right, you know, Excel is incredibly powerful with stuff like pivot tables, for example. And I know more and more of that stuff is coming into Google Sheets as time goes on. I love Google Sheets. I use it for almost everything. Google Docs is great for sort of basic documents, right? I think, you know, we don't make up our school newsletter in Google Docs, for example. We do that in Pages because it's much easier to make a very pleasing production in Pages. But in Google Docs, we have all kinds of stuff. Like we write policies in there. I write, you know, class tests in there and things like that and turn them into PDFs and so on. So we do that kind of thing in there. We never use Google Slides for anything, but I think we tend not to collaborate in presentations that much. But times when I have wanted to do that, it's actually worked really well. So we did it one time where we were having like our meeting of teachers after we'd done the exams, and we were doing a kind of post-mortem thing about how had the course gone and all that kind of stuff. And I made one presentation. I had everybody do one slide for their subject so that people didn't give me too many slides or whatever. That actually worked really well, and it was a lot easier than, you know, gathering 20 keynote files, for example. I find myself going across them all. You know, I'll use Google Docs. I'll sometimes use Word as well, but mostly Pages and Google Docs, but for different purposes. Bradley, one thing just about team drives that is maybe worth mentioning to people just as a matter of planning is that it's not really a downside. It's just a consequence of the design of Google team drives is that you can't, at least I can't figure out how to do this. You can't have differential access for people within the one drive, right? So for example, we have a drive that has a lot of sort of operational files in it. It's just called school data, and it's got things like the timetable, various other documents about minibus scheduling and things like that. But I can't make it so that, say, like every teacher can look at this, but three teachers can edit the files. I can't seem to quite figure out how to do that. And I also can't make it so that some teachers have got access to one folder and some teachers have got access to the other folder without basically putting nobody in the team drive and then sharing the folder individually. So it's one of these things where you kind of end up having as many team drives as you have different subsets of all your staff that need access to different things. So you end up, we've sort of ended up having the team drive list kind of mirror the organizational structure, if you like. It's kind of more, kind of an obvious consequence of the way the design is, but it's just something to be aware of, that you can't just have sort of one team drive that says school stuff and then, you know, give people differential access inside. Like, once people are in the drive, they're in the drive, and they can have, they can pretty much do anything. And the full permissions is the default, right? And that's the thing that I think is kind of a mistake in terms of the security of Google Team Drives, is that by default, if you invite somebody to a team drive, they can then invite other people to team drive. And I do not think that should be a default thing that people get to do. I think it should be the person who notionally owns the drive or created the drive should get to decide. But they are genuinely shared, so it's kind of one of these things where you got to take the rough with the smooth on that as well. But it's the way it works.
Yeah, we had that issue when we were doing our school magazine. It was all in a team drive. Well, then it came time to get that to our designer, his contractor. And well, then, okay, that's not going to work. So I had to pull everything out of team drive into my normal Google Drive, and then could share it with her regular Gmail account. Yeah. But again, I mean, the purpose of team drives, that downside is... it's one of those things you take with the, you know, it's like that's why regular shared folders still exist, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at. So yeah, that's certainly something to keep in mind. Especially as you add people and they need to know what's in there and the downsides of sharing that on.
Yep.
So to wrap it up, I want to talk quickly about G Suite backups, particularly for Drive. As we put more things in there, it becomes more critical data. How do you back that up? Obviously, it's in the cloud. We figure Google's not going to lose it, but you never know. But the bigger issue is, what if someone accidentally deletes something that's important and you don't realize it and the trash is emptied and you don't have a local copy anywhere and it's gone? A couple things you can do. One is look at a product called Spanning by EMC owns it. And now it's a cloud-based solution. Obviously, there's a monthly fee, or we had it for a while and paid yearly. You know, there's no hardware to manage. We've actually used this for years. I only had it rolling for about 6 people. They have a pretty good nonprofit discount. So if you just want to do hey, I just want to back up the finance person and maybe some of our admissions folks stuff, because these are business critical business documents. I cannot live without these. Maybe that's what you do. Now, one of the things we're moving to, I've actually just canceled our Spanning subscription that expires in February, is I am moving to a hardware-based solution for this from Synology. So Synology makes these various NAS devices, network-attached storage, that a lot of people love. They're good products. Now, they have an active backup for G Suite. And so what I'm doing is I'm going to have a... 4 4-terabyte drives. So I have 16 terabytes. So I'm going to have kind of no RAID on this, where it's literally if one of these drives dies, I'm done. But the thing is I'm mainly using this for this, this active backup. You're going to do this and one other thing. But again, I'm going to have something syncing from Dropbox that someone's going to access via SFTP. But if I lose this backup, it's fine. I mean, theoretically, I'm probably never going to need this. But what this does is, we have an interface for, I can log in with an administrator account and I can backup drive and team drive data. So I could be a continuous backup mode. And so then apparently there's a pretty good restore functionality and whatnot. So I'm pretty excited about this. I'll have a link to information about it in the show notes, but apparently you can even select just certain users and exclude others. I've got one user who uses 10 terabytes of storage. He has a lot of archives. So I can't back that up. You would need your whole separate, your own device for that. But I'll probably do, everybody else within reason. And so I'm pretty excited about it. So once I usually go cloud first and everything, but this I'm going just a hardware thing just so I can get more and more users. And it looks like it's kind of a set it and forget it thing. I'll install the package in the Synology, they call it Distation Manager, and log in and just let it run. And so, yeah, I'm pretty excited about it. I've actually already got one in, but apparently it only works on certain models. And I ordered the DS418, and it works on the DS418 Play. The $30 difference. I didn't realize that before I bought it. So, yeah, it's I just ordered it.
There's a lot of different models.
Yeah, it's I don't even know. I mean, why do you need that many SKUs? Yeah, just kill the 418 and just call, or kill the play and just make the play the 418.
Yeah.
Because we kind of started off on a negative foot from it. But I'm pretty excited about it. So that's kind of kind of what we're going to be doing for backups going forward.
How does it handle like native Google Docs files? Can it do something with that?
You know, it's, I guess, the same way that Spanning does. There's like an, I guess they're accessing the API from it. I've restored a couple things from Spanning before and it worked well. And yeah, I'm not sure kind of how they're doing it from a technology perspective, but they have like a, both of those companies have like a backup and a restore functionality. So it's not just like a taking this data and dumping it to a hard drive. Like there's an interface to drive.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Report back on how that goes. I might do the same thing.
Yeah, it's I'm pretty excited about it. I think it's gonna be kind of fun to play with. But I also just from as I you know, think about like budgets and things that are being planned and G Suite. And we had a document like 2 weeks ago that we thought we had lost, but you know, we had used somebody that had left, and then we thought we couldn't find a document. It turns out they'd created it on their personal Google account, and they were able to email it to us, which is a topic for another day. But that just got me thinking, gosh, what if we lose a document that like we need, and being able to restore it would be fantastic.
Yeah. I feel like right now we're so deep into Google Docs that I can't envisage a way in which we could get out of it. Even if we wanted to, you know, there's just so much stuff on there. It would have to be one of these things where we sort of start new documents in another service and then, eventually shut down Google Docs. But I don't see anything out there that I want to change to. I mean, Office 365, SharePoint stuff just seems terrible. You know, the only service where I've managed to have locking conflicts with myself on one file that I'm using in one place and somehow I've managed to lock it is pretty poor stuff. So, yeah, I think Google's got this one sewn up, to be honest with you. And even, you know, every, I don't know about every, but certainly a lot of iOS schools that I know, including my own, are backed by G Suite. You know, so it's not a case of either or really, although it's increasingly kind of difficult to justify. It's not difficult to justify iOS, that's the wrong thing to say, but it's becoming a pain to have a Google backend and an iOS front end because of the incredibly poor quality of the Google iOS apps. And that's something that somebody between Apple and Google needs to decide what's going on with that, because, you know, if these things continue to decline, I can see a world in which I end up putting a basic Chromebook on every teacher's desk as well. Just, you know, not out my own pocket, but certainly out my own budget to make sure that we can do our business documents, you know, and then, you know, where does that leave iOS? It's a device for teaching perhaps, but, you know,
well, that
it's a risk for iOS. I really think it is.
Yeah, it is. But when you don't own identity, if you're just the device, it's easier to replace the device than it is the identity stack. I mean, I would rather go back to Windows 100% before I switched from G Suite. I mean, just the difficulty of moving. I mean, moving from Exchange to G Suite was hard, but it was just literally email, and moving from Google Apps to something else would be, it'd be awful.
Yeah, I mean, it's becoming like it's the new Windows in schools, I think. It really is. And you can see from how hard like Microsoft are fighting to get people onto 365 and get ownership of that stack keep ownership of that stack in the Microsoft world. That's testament to how important this is. And Apple's just completely missed the boat on this entirely.
Amen to that. I guess we'll wrap it up for there this week. Thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks for jumping back with us after the holidays, and we'll be back here in a couple weeks with a new episode of Out of School, and I'll be able to report back on my G Suite backup. I may do like a screencast of the setup, actually. I think I'll do that. I'll do a quick screencast for it.
Cool.
We can share that. So thanks to our sponsor, Jamf. You can visit us on the web at outofschool.net. We'll have links to things we talked about. Find us on Apple Podcast at itunes.com/outofschool. And we're in Overcast and Pocket Cast and all those other fun apps as well. But if you're on Twitter, I'd love to connect with you at Bradley Chambers.
And I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter, spears.org on the web.
Have a good week, everybody.